Welcome to the CSM Podcast with David Nickturn. Creativity, spirituality, and making a buck. Blending spiritual and temporal realities, joining heaven and earth. We will be talking with a variety of manifestors, individuals who have, in one way or another, clarified their vision, created an offering, and brought that offering to the marketplace. Let's see what we can learn from them as we each move forward towards solving our own life puzzle, facing the challenge of living in the spirit, in the body, in the world, in this time. If you're interested in supporting the CSM podcast, please visit ehearnownetwork.com/David.
We've been conducting a 100-hour mindfulness meditation teacher training program at Samarasa, which was going to be in the flesh. Actually, Katie and I would have been out in LA for a part of the time. And so we switched to an online format. And it's particularly great that even in that context, we were able to pull Katie into the experience that we're sharing together. So that we're about to start our second weekend of that program, which is tomorrow and Sunday. But what we've been doing is every Friday night before the weekends, before the 4 weekends of the program, we have a workshop that's based loosely on my latest book, which is called Creativity, Spirituality, and Making a Buck. So some of you know it. And the idea is to look at integrating, creative expression, spiritual practice, and livelihood in a wholesome way. That's our goal there. And Katie was kind enough to join me in New York when we had one of these gatherings. And he and I are used to talking to each other, I have to say. We can go on for as long as we need to, and maybe a little longer. And the content of what we talk about ranges pretty widely. We'll probably loosely contain it to creativity and spirituality tonight, but
not necessarily in that order.
But not necessarily in that order, or in any order. And one of the things I say about KD is that he's, I think, my only friend who we can watch an NFL game and or the Super Bowl, and in the commercials we talk about Bardo states and such. So we have this kind of ongoing array of different interests, which obviously include music from different eras, and that's we're going to talk about that some tonight. Spiritual practice and American culture. So, KD, welcome! It's so great to see you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I wish you were here so I could give you a noogie.
I can feel it. Don't worry.
Okay. So we're going to do some talking, and KD will do some chanting. Usually we would play together. I play guitar with KD whenever possible. And you can't have two people at the same time in this format doing audio. So KD will do some kirtan, and you can sing along. And we'll do some talking. Then we're going to have some time for a Q&A from all of you. So KD, I wanted to start with, I have sat on the stage with you for hundreds and hundreds of hours. And there are certain themes that are in heavy rotation in your talking between the kirtans. So one of them is you've said that the mantra is the medicine and the music is the syrup. And I wanted to go a little deeper into that. We never really got all the way into that. I get the general idea of it, but could you say what you mean by that?
Well, people ask me all the time, about music in general and what it's good for, and can music be a spiritual path, or used as a spiritual practice? And of course, the main thing with any practice is the intention, why you're doing it, what you're bringing to it, what your motive is for doing the practice in the first place. Mostly when we listen to music to kind of forget ourselves and to dissolve ourselves into the sound or into the beauty of the music. And that's actually, that makes music just like any other sensual input, like movies or TV or food or anything that we use to satisfy our sense cravings. But, you know, if music was enough by itself, just as music, then every musician would be not only enlightened, but happy. So we know that that's not true. So when I say the music is the syrup and the name, the mantras that I sing are usually what they call in India the names of God, the divine names, or the names of that indwelling presence within us. And they say that these mantras or these names come from within us already. They brought into this world, into the world of the sense input, including thoughts, brought into this world by a being who's recognized reality through that practice and then brought that practice to people as a way for them to, you know, enter more deeply into their own hearts. So that's why I say music is the syrup. If a kid is sick and he or she needs to take medicine, you hide that medicine in something sweet. The sweetness of the syrup allows the medicine to be taken, but it's the medicine that cures the disease. And in this case, it's the mantras that are actually the medicine.
So, KD, could you do the mantras without the music? In other words, just your chanting?
Absolutely, yeah. But the music makes it easier to pay attention. You know, it uh-huh. It pulls our attention. But one has to cultivate awareness also. You can't fall asleep in the beauty of the music and just have a semi-ecstatic temporal experience. Mm. Because what we want is something that really lasts, you know, so is real and doesn't come and go. Mm. And that is where these names come from, that place within us.
So when you say those names, how many are there?
Well, there's David.
But
there's
that's not
names
that's,
there are names, you know.
Is that oh, okay. So you
there's
could
a million names. Any okay. name, but on the other hand, these are specific names. They're called revealed names. Whereas if you repeated, you know, Shri Frank, J Frank, JJ Frank, I'm not sure what's gonna happen to you. You might get a headache, or might all of a sudden yeah. you'll start meeting a lot of Franks in your life.
Yeah.
But well, I would prefer to meet Ram, actually, or
okay.
Kali.
So so these names have a special quality beyond...
They do. They do have a special quality, yeah. They're actually seeds. They're seeds that we plant in our mind stream. And just like any seed, a tiny little seed can have a huge oak tree in it. It has the potential in it. And these are the seeds that have the potential for awakeness.
And do you have like a top 10 of the names? Do you have a favorite one? Is there one that calls to you, like goes, this is really the one for you? How does that work?
Not really. You know, I'm a slut. I'll take it any way I can get it.
You're a deity slut?
A deity slut, yeah. You know, well, never mind. Long story.
Yeah. 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 I feel a little bit like I'm a little bit of a KD scholar, you know, because I've been, you know, been working together almost 20 years now. Do you know that?
No.
Yeah.
Remember how we met?
I do remember how we met.
I mean, I had seen you once before at uh-huh. the Tompkins Square Park.
Right, right.
Yeah.
You
led a meditation, you know, and I said, oh, that's David Nickturn. But we met actually at the... when Mickey's movie, Mickey's here too tonight, I saw him.
Mickey is, yeah, he's on.
Yeah, when Fierce Grace came out, we had that after party, after gathering. And that's how we met. That's when we met.
But so that's almost 20 years. And in that time, we've played together a lot. I produced a bunch of your records. We worked on a lot of music. And I got to know you as obviously as a kind of presenter in the landscape of spiritual practice in the West, the kind of what I call the UN of spiritual practice, but also as a musician. Now, here's the thing about KD as a musician, which is I'm sure everybody feels this or can sense it, he can really, as we would say in the business, kill a kind of traditional rock and roll or pop song. And so I've had friends of mine from the music business come up and say, you know, that guy could have been one of the, you know, Jackson Browne or a Bruce Springsteen, you know, and he will.
The jobs were already taken.
Yeah. Well, there were other slots open for Jeffrey Cagle, but at Soundcheck, sometimes we do songs that are, you know, from that kind of repertoire. And we do them with the harmonium and the tabla and guitars and stuff. And it sounds amazing. So I've been trying to get him to do what we call the Soundcheck album for years, really, really long time. And then we do those songs and then they drift into a mantra. So they go on for a while after that. So what I wanted to share, and then I want to, you know, ask Katie to kind of talk about it a little bit, is I would classify you as a music aficionado of our era, you know, that you really know a lot about music. You can sing those songs. You know the words. You know the history, you know who's singing what. And you owned a record company for a while, right?
I did.
Yeah. So you, as a music guy, you had a whole, I just saw a Star Trek episode today where they're all in different parallel universes. And in a parallel universe, you could have been, you know,
a contender,
an A&R guy, a rock singer, or, you know, folk rock guy. And so the path not taken. So I just wanted to, like, you know, feed your comment.
Definitely the path not taken.
Yeah.
You know, I guess some of you might know that when I was at college at Stony Brook, New York, in my sophomore year, I think it was sophomore year, I met, my third year, which was actually my second semester, but that's a long story. I met a couple of high school kids in the neighborhood that a friend of mine knew, and we started playing music together. But they were just getting to smoking dope, and I was just getting out, so that didn't last too long. They later became the Blue Oyster Cult. And the first name of the band was the Soft White Underbelly. It was the 60s. And I had just met Ram Dass, and I was going to live with him for the summer at his father's place. And I moved out of my house in upstate New York. Now I was living upstate, and I had my two dogs, my cat, all my worldly possessions in the car. And I drove down to Stony Brook for a Jimi Hendrix concert. And after the concert, the manager of the band came to me and they said, you know, the guy who replaced you, he can't sing in the studio. We have a whole record made. All we need is the vocals. Can you come back and cut the vocals? And we have a whole tour arranged. And I thought, oh, wow. There's no way I could do it, because I had met Ram Dass. And in my heart, I had met Maharaji, my guru. Everything paled before that. Everything paled. There was no possibility I was going to go that way. It wasn't even a decision. There was just no possibility.
So, how about in the rearview mirror, Katie? Did you ever look back and go, with or without Blue Oyster Cult? But I mean, was there any? Do you ever have dreams about being up on a stage singing those songs?
What do you mean? I'm on the stage all the fucking time.
No, but doing the other, yeah, of course.
Yeah, I'm sitting.
Well, that's an interesting point, though. That's an interesting point.
Well, I consider that's what my guru did. Mm. He transformed my negative karmas into positive karmas. Mm. He transformed the very things that I wanted that would have killed me into things that I wanted that actually were good for me. And that's the beauty of a Siddha guru, of a real guru, they can do that kind of thing. So now I get everything I wanted from being a rock and roll star. I can do it sitting down. I don't have to jump up and down all night. And it's completely, absolutely wonderful for my life, you know, because I wouldn't have lived if I had gone that other way. There's no question about it. It was close anyway, but definitely wouldn't have made it the other way.
So when you're home, do you listen to, what kind of music do you listen to when you're home? Or on the road?
I don't listen a whole lot. I listen to a lot of Tibetan stuff, a lot of mantras. Uh-huh. What else?
Well, who might be some of your
favorites?
Every
once in a while, not so much. I don't listen. when there's no input coming in, it's so relaxing.
Mm.
I mean, because before this little situation, I'm on the road for the last 25 years. So now I'm just sitting at home, it's quiet, and it's a joy for me.
You know, that's a funny thing, not to shoot off to the side a little bit. Quite a few people I've spoken to lately, I'm out of my house on Long Island. I've been here for 2 months. I haven't touched another human being. I've been here completely isolated for 2 months, but I'm very actively teaching several programs. So I have people in little boxes come to visit, you know, very regularly. Quite a few people I'm talking to are in some level, of course, the situation is very challenging, very difficult and kind of horrific in some ways, are like you, really enjoying the space and almost like the retreat quality of it.
It wasn't like I wasn't enjoying what I was doing. I really love touring. I love singing with people. It's the best thing I do in my life, as far as I'm concerned. But I'm experiencing now how much dust the mirror of my heart has picked up, being on the road, meeting so many people all the time, and not having a lot of time to just relax again into myself. So this forced retreat has been really wonderful. Mm. So, I mean, even with all the anxiety and all the stuff in the atmosphere, it's still been a very wonderful opportunity for me.
Yeah. I find quite a few people are saying that. It's kind of an intriguing aspect of this whole situation. But we've been trying to, with our, you know, we've been doing Dharma gatherings online for a variety of classes and stuff. I'm trying to do Tonglen practice before we get into other practices, just to reconnect and remember that there's a lot of people suffering right now. Just to somehow let some of that in, that energy in. But many people are having a similar, that we know, are having a similar experience of quiet and stillness and, you know, getting to catch up with themselves in a certain way.
Yeah.
So
another year or two and my room might be clean.
Yeah, because you're not exactly like Zen guy, are you?
It all depends how you look at it.
You're like the old school Chinese Zen, you know.
If you can see which way the underwear falls, you can appreciate his teaching.
Oh, this is a koan, is it not? Which way does the underwear fall, grasshopper?
Oh, yeah, very much, yeah.
Okay. So maybe if you're up for it, we could intersperse a little chanting and talk, chant a little bit. You're in the mood?
You're the boss. It's your class, whatever you want me to do.
I feel like we could just segue into that. Everybody could just sort of settle into some of that for a minute, you know?
Okay.
Yeah. As you wish, you know?
You know, one thing you just said struck me, you know, you talked about Tonglen, but in my tradition, the practices, you see, when we talk about the divine name or the names of God, one has to understand that that is the name of the inner presence that lives in every being, exactly the same. In India, they call it soul, but it doesn't necessarily mean, you know, something that's permanently separate. So, but they call that awareness. That awareness is the same in every being. So when you chant these names, you're invoking the place in yourself. We're invoking the same place in ourselves that is that place in every being in the universe. So that's how I bring that, the compassion or the loving kindness out, you know, into the practice.
Mm. It's built in, is what you're saying.
Yes, it's definitely built in. Even if you're not aware of it, you know, in my traditions, we don't talk about that as much in terms of practical techniques.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically, you know, when you get the hit, it will be for every all inclusive. So, so I'm going to sing. What am I going to sing? I'll sing some mantra. But I'm going to first sing a prayer that was taught to me by Bernie Glassman. Roshi Bernie Glassman was one of my dearest friends. And one day I got an email from him with 8 lines of this prayer. And he says, it said, could you do something with this? So I wrote to him, like what? And he wrote back, he said, well, we Buddhists aren't that good with melody. Maybe you could come up with a melody for this prayer, and then we could use it at the Zen Peacemaker gatherings. And he explained that this lines were from a prayer called the Kondron Mon. Did I say that right? Anyway, which means the gates of sweet nectar. And the idea being that through this offering, one enters into the gates, through the gates of sweet nectar, all beings, where all beings are interconnected and interdependent and part of oneness. So anyhow, so I carried those 8 lines around the world with me for about a year. He said the next gathering was 11 months later. So I said, okay, good. I carried them around with me. I'd look at them. They look at me. Nothing was happening. So I wrote them. I said, Bernie, can I mess with the words a little? I got a 1-line email back. Mess. So I rearranged the words and a melody came. And so I'll sing that for you. And then we'll sing a little Sri Ram Jai 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 Ram. Calling out to hungry hearts everywhere through endless time. You who wander, you who thirst, I offer you this Bodhi mind. Calling out to hungry spirits everywhere through endless time. Calling out to hungry hearts, all the lost and the left behind. Gather round and share this meal, your joy and your sorrow, I make it mine. Calling out to hungry hearts everywhere through endless time. You who wander, you who thirst, I offer you this heart of mine. Calling out to hungry spirits everywhere through endless time. Calling out to hungry hearts, all the lost and the left behind. Gather around and share this meal, your joy and your sorrow, I make it mine. Sri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. 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 Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. Sri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. Sri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. We can sing this together. Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. Sri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. Sri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. Sri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram.
So that's an interesting hybrid.
Yeah,
that is a hybrid of the the Buddhist tradition and the Bhakti tradition. And what's so interesting, KD, you know, about our world, I've been thinking about it a lot because I've been staying in touch. Danny Goleman came on this afternoon. We had the science of meditation. He sat in, kind of, so to speak. And I spoke to Marcella and Alberto earlier. And, you know, we have friends all over the world who are doing, you know, different kinds of spiritual practice from all over the world. And they're all coming together.
Danny and I went to India together.
He said that. And he was talking about his background and that Neem Karoli Baba was one of the first serious spiritual influences on it.
Sure.
So we've been, and, you know, and then we bumped into each other probably in the 70s, but didn't know it. It was like split screen, you know, like parallel universes. So you were at Naropa Institute that year that Ram Dass was there, right?
Sure. Yeah.
And then also we swap, you know, I'm a Buddhist guy hanging out in the bhakti world playing, and you come to a lot of the Buddhist teachings, and you have a lot of Buddhist influence in your teaching stream. So it's kind of all these things have blended together in interesting ways, but it's still interesting to kind of delineate some of the, especially for newer people coming in, just what the different traditions are, so they have some clarity about the different traditions. Don't mush it all together. So I thought we could talk a little bit about the guru aspect, because that's a really interesting topic when you speak with people from a Hindu tradition and a Buddhist tradition. And just to frame this with our group, you know, our teacher training group, and we'll be reviewing it tomorrow. We talked about the three yanas of the way Tibetan Buddhism is structured, is that there's three different levels of teachers. They're not every teacher is the same kind of presentation. And, you know, at the sort of Hinayana level, that the teacher is a preceptor or an elder. The Mahayana level is they're a spiritual friend or a mentor. And only in Tantra, in Buddhist Tantra, is they even use the word guru. So then Tantric Buddhism and Hinduism have more in common in some ways than Tantric Buddhism does with Hinayana Buddhism.
Oh, yeah, sure.
You know, so we share probably, you know, a primary relationship with our teacher as a kind of source of pith, core essence of what we're doing in our lives. And that's not necessarily the case in the lower yanas. You know, a teacher could just be somebody who knows a little bit and can kind of show you the way. So what I wanted to ask you tonight was, is there an equivalent in your tradition of a teacher further down the road who could be just an elder or a mentor or a spiritual friend? Is that part of the tradition too?
You mean in what context? You mean in like...
Well, for example, like Maharaji is your guru, right?
Yeah.
And many of the people coming along now, they have never met him.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's still possible they connect with him as the guru energy and the guru principle, but they can't go ask him whether they should, you know, change their job or go marry this one or that one, or, you know, they could ask you.
God forbid.
I don't know. There's worse counselors on the planet. There are worse counselors, you know. So you spend time with people, and you're a spiritual friend, I would say. Isn't that, don't you think so?
That's for you to say and me to suffer with. I have no idea.
Well, you always disclaim it. I know it's a nice disclaimer. It's like that box of Raisin Bran. It says, you know, there's no gluten in it or whatever it says, the disclaimer. And you always say you're not a teacher, but you are a mentor to a lot of people, Katie. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to make too big a deal out of it and make you all uptight or whatever, but...
Oh, it's okay. It goes through like Chinese food. It's okay.
Can you even get Chinese food now?
No. That's why I... Never mind.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, we've been doing this stuff for a long time.
Yeah.
And you just, it rubs off on you, you know, I mean,
yeah,
you're just around these teachings, you're around these incredible beings, you read these books. I mean, there's so much that you just absorb that comes in under the radar. And then the practice is, I always see it as a ripening practice. I really don't consider that I've ever been able to learn anything in terms of philosophy or understanding how things work. I can barely tell Brahma from Vishnu or Shiva, I tell you. And I've been in India my whole fucking life. But there's a ripening that goes on underneath the radar. And what changes is the way you live in your own being. But you don't get to do a trip about that. You don't get to do it because it's the evaluator, the judgmental mind that's thinning out and going away. So you don't spend so much time in negative states of mind. So as a result, you're not quite as reactive as you were in the past, and you're more present.
You mean just as a result of chanting, doing the practice, chanting?
Well, it's not just the chanting. It's the way you see yourself. In other words, you talked about the guru. So there's two ways to go, you know. One is the path of wisdom, the path of understanding, and the path of that you're going to do this, you're doing this, and these are your techniques, and this is your practice. The other way is the path of, you could say, devotion or surrender. Mm. So my job is to let go. My job is not to understand. I don't care if I understand or not. I want to be able to continually let go of whatever limitations I might feel, whatever negative emotions might be pushing me around. And at the same time, you start to be even let go of thinking about yourself as the doer. Hmm. That's a different aspect of practice than this other way. Of course, everything leads to the same place, but it's a question of how you go through your day. So, but, you know, so one day Maharaji grabbed my book, my notebook, where I wrote down all these prayers and spiritual stuff, you know. And he was going through it. He went through it and he stopped at this one page and he says, "What's this?" And I looked at it. I went, "Oh, shit." It was the song of Mahamudra, right? And I thought, "Oh, my God, this is, you know, I'm in my Guru's Hanuman temple. What am I going to do?" There it is. Yeah. So I said, "Oh, it's Buddhist, you know." So he said, "Translate some." So there was an Indian guy there, and he translated a few verses. Maharaj goes, "Peak, correct, very good." And I went, "What? Really?" He kept going through the book. He came across a little picture of him that I had between the pages of the book. He says, "Yeah, who's this?" I said, "Maharaji, it's you." "Nay, Buddha." So many of us who were with him have done so much Buddhist practice over the years. It's amazing, really.
Well, and we're in this very active dialogue. Like some of you have been to the Maui retreats, which unfortunately, yeah, we would have had the first one post Ramdas, and that it got probably postponed for quite a while. Who knows how long, but we'll see. Yeah. But before that, we were going there. How long had you been going there? Like about 15 years, 12 years, something like that?
No, not so long.
No, 10? Final offer.
Well, maybe close to 10 years. There were some smaller ones first, and then we moved over to the bigger place. Yeah.
And there was always, you know, you doing yours, Ramdas teaching his way. And then they would always invite Buddhist teachers like Joan Halifax and Jack Kornfield. And
Bob
it was
Thurman.
Bob Thurman, Sharon Salzberg.
Sure.
And it was so, I mean, one of the things, I'm going to cry if I think about this because we're not going to get to go there right now. So that's something I look forward to every single year. And we were going twice a year. But it's a very peaceful, very harmonious group. I mean, a bunch of old crotchety people in the first place. But considering that,
but
you know,
when
a
you're
lot,
crotchety together, it's kind of
yeah, group crotchet, you know,
group crotchety.
Davy crotchet, yeah. So, you know, there was a certain feeling of like living in a world in a way you thought this is really what it's supposed to be like. People have different points of view and whatever, and you talk about it and you practice, and then everybody comes together. So I think we have to, you know, somehow figure out how to carry that. We have to somehow carry
we'll see.
I think. Yeah, that umbrella.
We'll see.
Yeah. So the guru is, you know, maybe if you could say for people who don't, let's say, know about that form, what that is, even. Like
a real
Western
guru, yeah, is different than a teacher, is different than just about anything you can imagine. Because a real guru doesn't want anything, only exists for one reason, which is out of compassion for those of us who don't know what the hell's going on. They don't manipulate, they don't need you, the real gurus don't even need to see you physically. If you do happen to meet your guru in a body, it's because you needed that at that time. If you don't need it, it doesn't happen because it's not the best thing for you. The real guru, and even in Tibetan practice, the first thing you do in order to qualify for the so-called higher teachings, you have to merge your mind with the mind of the guru, with the heart of the guru. There has to be a merging. And through that merging, you finally point in the right direction. You're pointed in the right direction. And from that point on, other teachings can come to you. But without merging the mind and heart with the mind and heart of the guru, we really are not alive yet, actually. We're not awake. Our hearts aren't really moving in the right direction.
So if you had to give a definition of the word, because it's not, an English word, how, and you were trying to explain it to, let's say, somebody who didn't really have background to understand the concept, is there another word you would use? Are there other words you would use to kind of communicate what it is?
All I can say is that, the fantasy, how we imagine what it'll be like when we fall in love forever, and we'll always be in that love, and it'll always feel just the way we want it to feel. That's the guru. That's the guru. And because that love is what lives within us as who we are, and the guru can help us clean the mirror of our hearts so that that love is reflected accurately and fully, and we don't just see the dust on the mirror.
It is sometimes the process of cleaning the dust on the mirror of the heart other than sublime?
Oh, yeah. I was in India for 2.5 years with Maharaji. He kept me there. He allowed me to stay. He sent me to his devotee, who was the chief of police, who stamped my passport, gave me a year visa. Otherwise, I would have been sent home way early. And then one day he looks at me and said, "You go back to America. You have attachment there." I said, "Baba, I'm just learning Hindi. Too bad. Ciao. You go." And that was his teeth. That was it.
And no negotiation.
Absolutely no negotiation. Although, in retrospect.
Yeah. Huh.
In retrospect. He used to send us away a lot. He used to say, "Go away" is my mantra. And so we would go. But there was one guy who used to go. He would leave the temple. And then he would wait until everybody dispersed. Then he'd run back in the temple and Maharaja would let him stay.
Uh-huh.
So in retrospect, I could have come to America, said hello to my parents and gone right back.
Uh-huh.
But I didn't, because what he said was true. Uh-huh. I had attachment in America.
What were you attached to?
What wasn't I attached to?
That's what I said. What weren't you attached to?
I had dreams and desires and fantasies and things I wanted to do. And when I left for India, I gave everything away. I sold everything I had because I was never coming back because I hated myself, my American self. I loathed myself. I had so much self-hatred and self-loathing that I couldn't imagine staying here if I didn't have to. So my fantasy was going to America, to India forever. So he sent me back to work on all that stuff.
And that was painful.
Very painful. Oh.
Did you ever blame him for it? Like, why did you send me back here? Or did you get it? You understood?
No, I didn't blame him. Yeah. How do you blame somebody who's, you know, who's the love you want to be? You know?
Oh, there's a song.
Yeah.
How do you blame somebody who's the love you want to be? I think it's the B side to I Can't Tell. What did you say? I can't tell Brahma from Vishnu, but what was the second half of that? I don't know what it had a fuck in it. I don't know what the fuck was going on or something like that. Does anybody remember? Nobody.
We'll watch the replay later.
Okay, we have it on the recording. Yeah. So there is, you know, would you call that purification? What would you call that?
Sure.
You know.
Mm-hmm. This was not a teacher.
Right.
This was what they call a siddha, someone who just changed you. Mm. He didn't ask your permission. Mm. He didn't need to because he lives inside of you as who you really are. And so looking out from within you, he can say, okay, you need a little bit more of this, a little bit more of that. And then he just changes your life. That's what happens for you. You get to work out the very things that are preventing you from knowing who you really are. So I suppose this is a little esoteric, but you know, this is the way you look at it on the path of surrender.
Yeah. Well, so that would include COVID-19. That would include Ram Dass's stroke.
Absolutely. You know, Ram Dass used to say, as Mickey will attest to, that Maharaji stroked him. Mm. That Maharaji gave him the stroke as a teaching. Mm. He used to say that, and he believed that.
Yeah.
But when he finally went back to India for the first and only time after the stroke and met Siddhi Ma, who was an incredible saint in her own right and Maharaji's great devotee, she said, Ram Dass, that's not correct. Maharaji would never give you a stroke. The stroke was your karma. Huh. The grace that Maharaji gives you is that you were able to use that and able to overcome that stroke and you know, purify your heart even with that kind of practice you have to do in that intense situation.
So the devotion actually is part of a process of accelerating your karma.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So on that note, there's one other main topic I wanted to get into, but why don't we throw it open to the group if you have any questions for both, either of us, and maybe Lucy, could you just pick somebody, and if you like, you can just come on and read their own question, you know, so that we see who they are. So please just jump in if you have a question, comment. Maybe that wasn't clear. Just turn on your mic and start talking and go for it. Oh, Michael?
Yeah, I have a question. I've thought a lot about this and wondered about the connections or differences between Hinduism and Buddhism and if they're even relevant or significant to the two of you.
Yeah. So, and just that's maybe everybody can say who they are too first, but that's Michael Chipman who works at Samarasa, but is a wonderful singer, KD, just to put that in context. And he's one of the meditation teachers. It was trained, so, but he's really got a beautiful voice.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
So what was the question again? Repeat it.
Hinduism and Buddhism, similarities, differences. Right, Michael, is that right?
Yeah, the differences, similarities, and are they significant or important? Or because the more that I read spiritual teachings from all these traditions, they all seem very similar. Seem to be coming towards the same ideas of connection and compassion and that we're all one, we're all part of the same energy. And I just wonder what the two of you coming to what you do from two different traditions, how you see those connecting or not.
Well, Maharaji used to go like this. And like this. So we always wondered what we were getting busted for, you know, something we had done, because he knew everything, something we had done, something we were going to do, or something we're thinking about doing, you know. So we said, Maharaji, what does that mean when you do that? And he went, okay, what does that mean? That many names, many forms, all one. All one. Many paths, all one. So that made it easy for me. You know, that means I didn't have to worry about whether this one fit intellectually or not, whether this puzzle fit together perfectly or not. If I was attracted to some teaching, I would just go for it. And it didn't have to make sense necessarily on the intellectual level. Because I felt that from what he said, that everything, you know, fed into that oneness or that one of which we're all a part. The big thing about the biggest difference, they say, you know, they asked Buddha, is there a God? He didn't say anything. It's not that he said no. He was silent. And there were certain questions that he was asked that he did not answer. And it wasn't that there were negative answers. He would not answer for whatever reason. And one of the big issues is the idea of no self, anatma in Buddhism. But I feel, and I could be wrong, that this is really just a question of how you define self. Because even from the Hindu side, the so-called Hindu side, it would be very hard to find a real guru who believed that there was anything that was permanently always separate from everything else, including the soul, so to speak, or the self, capital S self. So even that, it's like a station on the way. It's not the final reality, it's relative reality. Pretty high up relative reality, but still relative. And so what his teachings came out of in the culture of the time, they were very revolutionary, because at that time, the Brahmins or the priestly class were controlling everything. And the belief was you couldn't find liberation unless you got, you know, you paid the Brahmins money to do pujas for you and prayers. So he was leading a revolution against that. So he was trying to give people back their power and take it away from the priestly class. So,
which is what Jesus did too, right, KD? That's
really
what
Jesus did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny when you talk about this. I just looked back, you know, KD and I text each other pretty regularly, and it can range, as I said, in topics. So I just thought, well, what have we sent back and forth in the last week? And he sent me a video of Morihei Ueshiba, who's the founder of Aikido. Okay. And then he sent me this video, which is an African guitar player. And then he sent me this picture, which is the 16th Karmapa, one of the greatest Buddhist masters of the 20th century. And then he sent me this picture, which is Mingye Rinpoche, who we've been talked about this afternoon. He's the wonderful Tibetan Lama who went on a 3-year retreat by leaving his monastery behind, 4 years, and wandered throughout India and other places, and who's very actively teaching now. And then, and this is where, Michael, this is one I'm really thinking of for you. This is one of the head of the Nyingma School of Tibetan Buddhism named Dzogchen Rinpoche. So these are all, we call them the blues masters. You know, they're like, you can't duplicate this. It's Muddy Waters. It's Junior Wells. You know, it's the people, you can't make this, you cannot recreate the causes and conditions that caused these people to manifest the way they did. We carry on, but they had some. And then he said, well, wait a minute, look at the insignia here. And Michael, I'm thinking of this with you in terms of what's the difference or similarity of this. And it says this.
This is Dzogchen Rinpoche's picture.
Dzogchen Rinpoche's picture. And he says, look at this photo. Then look at your mind. look at the one who is looking. If you see this, you are the excellent one. That doesn't say Buddhist anywhere in it. So this is a lot of these schools did overlap. They all have esoteric and exoteric. You know, they have the rituals, the outer form, and they have the inner form, and they have what's called the outer, inner, and then secret aspect. So a lot of it's karmic, you know, what you resonate with. It's amazing, even within Buddhism, some people gravitate towards Theravadan Buddhism, insight meditation. Some people love the tantric stuff. Some people just love the Mahayana, the oozing bodhisattva heart. And, you know, so I think it's good that we're clear about what we're doing. If we have a precise practice, like there's very precise practices that KD's community, they do the Hanuman Chalisa. Everybody does that a fair amount. It has a certain, to me, I resonate with that practice a lot because it has a kind of warrior quality to it, and, you know, and a Buddhist flavor to me. There's a sadhana practice that I do that has Ganesh in there, you know, which is a Hindu deity. A lot of the Buddhist deities were sort of taken from Hindu deities. We borrowed Garuda. We borrowed Ganesh.
Hanuman's in the Kala Chakra.
Yeah. So there's a lot of crossover, but at the same time, when you are following a tradition, I believe you should have some real deep knowledge of that tradition that you're doing, so that it does, you're digging a well, but it doesn't mean that the other wells aren't as deep. But if you dig a lot of little wells, we say, you know, just you keep trying this and trying that, maybe it's, you just keep refashioning the world after your own image in a way.
Maybe the water's only an inch deep.
Well, didn't you try to drown in, what was that story? You tried to drown in an inch deep water?
Never mind.
Okay. All right. Anybody else?
I got a question here. Parker Simon. I've been a touring musician for years and more recently been working as a production manager on the venue side of things. And I'm curious how really both of you deal with just kind of the handling of money, settlement, and how you do that on a physical level and the spiritual level too, and how that mingles. Because I've been on all sides of those deals where it's, I'm just curious about that. It's,
sure.
You know, a lot of times it feels smooth, sometimes it feels kind of dirty.
And to take money for playing, you mean?
In certain situations, maybe, or if you feel like you're not getting what you deserve, it can bring up, really intense emotions and can ruin relationships. And I'm just curious.
Well, Parker, first of all, you definitely need to read the book. It's all about, well, wait a minute, is that part of the world somehow separate from the other parts? In my world there, it's the same principles continue to apply, which is integrity, skills that you need, you know, in particular areas. But I've talked to KD about this the last time we talked in New York. KD runs a very clean and good business. And it's, you know, it would be funny if, like, we got up there and went, like, it's all one. It's like, oh, I forgot that, you know, you check out of the hotel room, you go, like, their credit card bounced or something like that. But it's all one. Use his credit card, you know? So they do practice, and the Ram Dass retreats, they have integrity about that aspect of the world. So you don't get into any trouble at all about it. You know, it's clean. It's, you know, people are respected for their time and effort. There are a lot of volunteers, but they're there because they're doing seva. They want to participate in some way. So, yeah, for me, just to short circuit that, business is fine. It's just greed that's not great, and cheating's not good, and lying's not good. But business is fine. In fact, people should be good at business. And if they're doing it, why not be good at it? So, KD, you want to say anything about that part?
As far as money,
yeah, money.
It slips through my fingers so fast I can't even, you know. But you know, I was struck by what you said. You know, as a touring musician, you know, the feelings you express to us. If you took your life as your teaching, then when those feelings of unjust rewards to yourself and not getting enough of this, if you took your life as your teaching or as your guru, then you would be able to work with those feelings more successfully and more usefully. But because you feel a victim and you feel entitled to that victimization. You know, you keep doing it to yourself. So that brings a lot of negativity and a lot of tension, a lot of anger, all that stuff. It's not really coming from the situation in the moment. You're bringing it to the moment. And you're allowing yourself to be hurt by that. And really, you could turn it around and, oh, wow, you know, how wonderful these bastards are who are ripping me off. They show me what an asshole I am, you know. Thank you, you know. But to really feel that, it's intense, you know. So like David said, you know, the light has, it's everywhere, you know. You have to allow it to come in, which means you have to look at yourself. And as far as the way we do it, you know, we've never, until very recently, when we never have contracts, we never ask for advances or anything like that. We always share the gate. And because I feel if people don't come, why should the organizer suffer, right? And the other thing, because of the nature of what I do and the way it happened, it's all by invitation. You know, for me, I could sing three times a day in a different place for the rest of my life, you know, because of the invitations, because that first CD I made went viral all around the world. So because it's invitation, we're invited to come, we go, we split the proceeds in a way that works for everybody. Only been ripped off twice in 25 years, you know. Both of those people are still alive, but yeah. So I figure it's not a bad record, you know.
Maybe we could have a couple more questions and then do one more kirtan. Yeah, we have Teresa, who's one of our teacher trainees.
Hi there. Can you hear me? Okay.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi, Katie. I've seen you several times, and I love your music, and you've really brought me through the past 10 years of my life being a yoga teacher, and inspired me in many ways. But I have a question for you tonight. The blanket in the background, was that perhaps your guru's blanket?
What blanket?
The one that's folded on the wall.
That one, yeah. This blanket?
Yeah, yeah. What's the story with that one?
In 1972, I had a few rupees in my pocket for some reason in India, and I was in Delhi, and I brought Maharaji a blanket, and I had a dream that he wore it in the temple, and I saw him coming around a corner wearing this blanket. So then I found that color blanket in Delhi and I brought it to him. And sure enough, a couple of days later, he was walking around the corner in the temple and I was standing there and he was wearing that blanket. And then that was that. I didn't know, you know, last September we were in Greece and I went to visit a very old friend of mine who was with me, with Maharaji, on one of the Greek islands, spent a few days with her. And as I was leaving, she asked me to come into her room and she opened the closet. She reached in and she pulled out the blanket that I gave to Maharaji in 1972 and she gave it to me. And that's that blanket.
Wow. Yeah. That is an amazing story. So can I have a part two of my question?
Of course.
Did I unmute?
You're good. We hear you, Teresa.
Okay. Is there a part two to my question I can ask?
Of course.
Are there other incarnations of Maharaji out there?
You're getting into deep water here. I'm not sure that how to put this. It's very probable that the body that we saw burnt after he supposedly left it wasn't his only body in the first place. So So that's one answer. You know, we live in this world, right? And we think it's real. But you know how when you wake up, you realize, oh, that was a dream, you know? So these beings that we call saints or bodhisattvas, they're awake and they know this is a dream, this world. And just, have you heard of conscious dreaming? It's a technique you can develop. Well, they're doing that all the time. And they enter into this dream in as many bodies as they want to, in any form that they want to, out of compassion for us. So I'm not convinced that that body that was burnt was real in any way whatsoever. However, I don't personally have experience of that. This is called the crazy side. So it's very possible that he's living somewhere else and just doesn't want us to see him this time. Just like he wanted us to see him last time. Who knows? It's up to him. All I can do is surrender and get a little pissed off that I can't see him.
Thank you.
Sure.
Hello, my brothers. My next in the questions?
Go ahead, Tom. You're good.
Thank you, Dave. Dave, we met actually about 10 years ago in Barrington, Rhode Island, at Eddie Mello's studio, Freedom Yoga. We had dinner that night as well. And Krishna Das, been listening to you since that same time frame. Thank you both. This is a great experience for me to be here with you both. It's hard to find one question to ask you both, right? But so I was thinking I'd ask you the question that David asked Clancy on Midnight Gospel that I just found today. Shout out to David on that. That was good. So how do you know if you're enlightened? How does one know that? What do you feel?
You when you put your pants on, they're in the right direction.
KD.
Sir.
KD and Tom.
Yes,
my
sir.
Friend Stanley out in Los Angeles, who's a screenwriter. One time, you know, there's a very famous Buddhist story about what you're asking, which is that Buddha touched the ground and the earth shook. They asked him, how do you know you're enlightened? And it's called the earth witness mudra. So you see a lot of Buddha statues with the right, one of the hands touching the earth. So how do you confirm your enlightenment? And he said, this solid earth is my witness. And the earth shook. And so, you know, there's a metaphor to that, which is he's really grounded. He's stable. He's, you know, he's not vibrating all over the place. He's, you know, in touch with, he's joining heaven and earth, as we say about it. But then, so my friend Stanley, I said, when I were up, Stanley stays up till 4 a.m. every night. And you have to kind of, I like take a nap between like 11:30 and 12:30, and then I have to hang with him till 4 if I'm staying at their house. And one time we were just saying, he said, I'm definitely not enlightened. And I said, well, Stanley, how do you actually know you're not enlightened? And he said, this solid earth is my witness. So, yeah, it works. It what's that song? It cuts both ways, you know?
Yeah. Okay. So
it's
more of a, not something you achieve and you just achieve it. It's in and out of it. You know, you have it, maybe then you don't have it. Or if you have it, you always have it.
Well, that's such a complex question, you know, from, you know, we spent a whole weekend a couple of weeks ago with this group of people and sort of threading that particular needle. But, you know, you could also say there are stages of realizations, particularly in Buddhism. It's not like there's something called Samyaksambuddha, which is total, final, like, you know, complete, total realization. But along the way, you know, there's a lot of stages. There's the bodhisattva path, there's the arhat, you know, when you say realizing, there's something you're realizing and something you're stabilizing and something then you begin to manifest. So it's pretty rare that somebody has, you know, in the path, the non-returning path, kind of. And then, even then, the person comes back as a bodhisattva. Even then, they might have little refinements they're working on. So I think, you know, for me, it's, I don't want to say it's a moot point, because when you do meet, like Katie sent me a film of Karmapa 16 along in that text, and you see him getting up on the throne doing the black crown ceremony, you go like, well, I don't know what the full thing looks like, but this sure looks pretty awesome, you know? So, but are you practicing, Tom?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So right now I'm a social worker. So, you know, each day I'm practicing. I think I'm on the bodhisattva path, but, you know, each day meditating, trying to stay mindful, chanting. Chanting has been such a, you know, whenever I'm off my game, and I'm often off my game, I'll put on my shuffle, my iPod, and, you know, and Krishna will come on there, and I, you know what, brings you back. I'm angry, and I'm like, oh, fuck this guy, you know. All of a sudden, Shambho, and I'll be, all right, that's good, you know. So, you know, you get back into it. And then I have, so David, your first album comes up as well. You know, that the first one we found back, way back then, I think it was Simplicity. Simplicity comes on too, and it, that grounds me. So, you know, back to the earth, and breath, I come in and out of it, you know, when I get angry sometimes, the world, how it is, and the oppressed, and how much can I change? How much can I not change on this? Just go around, and it's a struggle.
And where do you live, Tom?
I live in Pawtucket, Rhode Island.
Oh, huh? Okay.
Where?
Rhode Island?
Pawtucket.
Pawtucket, Rhode Island.
Rhode Island, so
Pawtucket. Yeah, Rhode Island is a little small state.
Well, thanks a lot for checking in. It's really good to have you with us.
It's been great. It's been a true pleasure. Thank you.
Oh. I think maybe we could close, KD, you know, maybe something just put us all to bed. You got anything? Just...
Baba Hanuman.
That'll put you to bed?
No, that's for the morning.
Oh, that could put you to bed. It's slow. Yeah. The first part is slow. Let me see. We'll let Mama put you to bed.
Swaha, Swadha, stute ani namo stute arayani namo stute arayani namo stute Siddhi Buddhi Prade Devi Bhukti Mukti Pradayani Mantra Murti Mahadevi Mahalakshmi Namostute Narayani Namostute Narayani Namostute Narayani Namostute Sarva Badha Vinirmukto Dhana Dhanya Sutamato Manushyo Matrasadeno Bhavishyati Sunshine Arani Namostute Arani Namostute Arani Namostute
It just started to very gently rain.
Here too, yeah.
There too?
Here too.
Yeah.
Here too four.
Well. I'm so glad we could gather like this tonight. It's very special. We're kind of doing some extra heavy lifting to be able to communicate and commune together. So I'm glad everybody's making the effort. That's much very appreciated. Especially thank KD for joining in tonight. And I miss you, KD. It's really nice to be with you this way. Thank you very much for coming. And thanks to the staff at Samarasa for putting this together, to Susan and Lucy. Don't forget Samarasa in your activity there. You have lots of things going on online. If you want to know what KD's up to, you can go to krishnadas.com, samarasacenter.com. And we'll be continuing, those of us who are doing the teacher training, we start at 9 a.m. LA time tomorrow morning. So we'll regroup and keep going. A broken heart keeps beating just the same. Old bluegrass tune. So, okay. And Anna, thank you for helping out with the audio too. Okay, everybody. Till soon. Nighty night.